Hello and welcome to Kicking the Karaoke,
the intersectional feminist podcast dedicated to platforming the voices, stories and narratives mainstream media and society ignore.
We are your hosts, Sid and Elena.
Hello.
We sound really similar and it's a bit confusing, but it's not about us. It's okay. It's about you and our guests.
Last month we covered aid and we're really happy with how it turned out.
And so are you. There was so much praise for this, which is really great. We really wanted to tackle the topic for ages and we weren't sure how, so we're really glad that you liked it and you told us about it, so keep doing that.
And we're definitely going to be encouraging more people to say their age from now on. So here's to smashing that age stigma.
And to a few shout-outs.
Alice Wallace said that it was really interesting and particularly liked Chrissy's contribution from Opening Doors.
Juliet said it was one of her fave episodes so far.
Martha said that she could listen to Nuala all day because the point she made was so good. You and us both, sister.
And Carl Charles from episode 8, remember him? Said it was a great episode and thanked our guests for tackling these issues.
So, on to episode 18. I can't believe it's episode 18. That's absolutely wild. So, we're going to be talking about language.
In the past 12 months, how many times have you heard someone up in arms about pronouns? Is it they? Is it she? Is it he?
And the word queer. 20 years ago, that would have been a homophobic slur. Now it's almost a badge of honour. How has that happened?
What about the N-word? Is it ever okay for white people to say it?
And maybe you're a person of colour and you've been told that you sound articulate.
But it's a compliment, right? Being articulate is a good thing, right?
Language is important. Far more important than we realise. It's been said before that if you want to control the way a population thinks, you take away their language.
This is a massive topic that intersects with colonialism, slavery, LGBTQ plus culture, class, and the list goes on.
So we have three amazing, and we mean amazing, guests to tell us why language is important to them.
First up is JJ.
My name is JJ Bola. I'm a writer, poet and educator. I am from Kinshasa, Congo. I was born in Congo. I came to the UK with my family as refugees. I am of African descent. I'm African. I identify as male and heterosexual and inner city, working class Londoner with relative privilege in terms of education, but disadvantage in several other circumstances. So yeah, this is probably like the most interesting way I've ever introduced myself. So thank you for kind of giving me that opportunity to reflect on my own identity as well.
Cool. That was, yeah, that's really interesting. So super excited to have you as a guest on this podcast. It's all about language. So why is language important to you?
I think for me, how it came to be important for me was how language confronted me, or how I confronted language. Coming into a new country and not knowing the language, particularly at a young age, makes you realise that you can't communicate necessarily in the way that you're used to or in the way that you'd like to. So being born in Congo and there till I was about 7 years old, I was really familiar with the language and able to communicate quite freely. But then you move to a new country and then you learn that your language isn't accepted in the way that it should be. And not only that, the majority of people don't speak your language. So outside of your home, the way that you're understood within the education system or even just within the playground, it really has an impact on your own development and also how it pertains to particular obstacles. So I speak Lingala, I speak English, I speak French. Three languages considered to be quite a lot, but I come from a family where my dad speaks about 6 languages, my mom speaks 5. So it's quite ordinary to be multilingual in our household. But outside of our household, it was seen as being quite a negative thing. African languages were just not accepted at all. I think language is important to me because it contains so much. It contains culture, it contains education, it contains knowledge, but also it contains power and how we transmit power and ideas and how people come to understand the world. If we're looking at structures of oppression, if we're looking at issues of like imperialism and neocolonialism, colonialism, one of the most effective means of colonizing people was to take away their language and replace it with the language of the oppressor. So if we look at Congo, for example, that was colonized by Belgium, the language of the state became French. And the Congolese people who spoke French were actually labeled évolué, which means evolved. So if you could speak French fluently and articulately, French people, Belgian people called you evolved. So again, it was a way of creating a hierarchy that essentially dehumanized the people through language. So that's why language is important to me.
I wanted to talk to you about the colonial legacy of things like language, especially in Britain. Do you think that there is still a lasting impact from that today?
Yeah, absolutely. We speak like colonialism was something that happened like years ago, and it's just stopped when it said it was stopped. But it completely transmits into our daily lives even now. Now, if I look at my position, you know, of being a writer and an educator, which is a very privileged position to be in, particularly from someone who comes from a former colonized country of the global south, but also comes from a background of refugees whose my own grandparents can't read my work. And so kind of operating within that space of privilege here in the UK, the UK is a very classist society. And so a particular profession or particular level of education almost ties you into a certain class. And so me operating within the realms of language as I do as a writer, people almost immediately assume that I'm middle class, not that I grew up on some estate. And so it's all these associations that come with language, that come with the way you speak, that come with the way you write. And people essentially reveal their own prejudice to you relative to how they interpret your existence. We're very underrepresented in the publishing industry. And as a young black male, the assumption is always that you're going to use slang. And when you do, that also is stigmatized. So the assumption is that you're not as educated, or you're not as intelligent, or you're not able to transmit particular ideas. For me, you know, not that there's anything wrong with using slang, but they shouldn't have those associations with it. It permeates our lives, like on an everyday basis, down to even, for instance, I've been kind of challenging this on Twitter, but I've not really had a response. And so feel free, whoever's out there, like to address this and to give me an answer. So what's been happening a lot is a lot of the kind of liberal mainstream media has been, and a lot of black writers as well, have moved in this direction, in that when they are writing black in relation to the people, they write it with a lowercase b rather than a capital B. So say, for instance, if they're saying, okay, black British, right, they'll capitalize the B in British, but not the B in black. And for me, black, in reference to the people, is an identity, it's a status, it's a culture, like it's a collective noun as well. So those should be capitalized, right? And I always see like there's a certain power and recognition and acknowledgement in having a name capitalized. So I've never really been given an answer to that. I've constantly thrown it out there, but no one's really answered that. And I think even that has a particular level of significance. These little things that if we just allow it to pass by unchallenged, that it just becomes the norm and it seeps into our conscious, our subconscious. For me, if we're not having this conversation like internally as black people, then there's an issue. And I kind of feel like, of course, it's great that there's a lot more representation in the mainstream regarding black issues, but the nuances of these conversations, if we don't control the narrative, it can set us back in one example and then move us forward in another. And then where is the progress there?
I guess it's like a double-edged sword, in the sense that it's good to have these like issues out in the front and being talked about, but if it's not being like talked about by the right people or in the right way.
Right. And that's the kind of fear and problem that I have, in that a lot of the mainstream corporations are now realizing that black Twitter or black presence online has a real influence. And so they're almost to a certain degree co-opting the image of the struggle. They're really profiteering off that. And for me, that feels disingenuous, because if your mainstream media organizations are representing the issues that black people have, but within the offices they're not employing black people, then that to me feels contradictory. So yes, representation is important, but if we can't survive as people, as black people, within a white supremacist structure, then what use does it do anyone for us to be visible but not be able to live? You know, so that's the kind of issue that I really have with it.
What do you make of the language that the media uses to talk about refugees and immigrants?
There's a particular very loudmouthed person in this country, a woman who represents very bigoted, I think you're thinking the same person.
Haiti Copkin.
Yes. See, I didn't even need to say it. They refer to refugees as cockroaches. That's like completely dehumanizing. And I think the language that is used is essentially trying to remove the humanity of a group of people. When that happens in regard to any identity, you're essentially justifying the deaths of those people. Look at myself as an example, because, you know, I come from a refugee background. I really remember coming into the country and doing the whole fingerprints, everything, like detention centres and having family members and friends and people in the community who have been deported and so forth, and being like going on marches and so forth. But from my own experience, being both refugee but also someone who sounds like they're very much integrated and included in the society. No one ever assumes my refugee background because of the way I speak and so forth, and I look very integrated. So one of the things that happens is people feel comfortable to express their prejudice towards you because they see you more like them rather than the people who have been othered. There was a time where at the school that I worked in, it was break time, lunch time, I was speaking to a few colleagues of mine, and we were talking about what's going on in papers and so forth, and a couple of them said, oh yeah, you know, the refugees are coming over, and essentially the whole kind of rhetoric that you see in the newspapers. Now, these are educated people, people who've gone to universities, and that's why you think, you know, oftentimes, like, these ignorant views kind of labelled as something that only working class people have. No, it's widespread. Like, it's very educated people have these prejudiced views. And so they were saying these. And then I challenged them, told them about my own experience. I told them about how we came into the country. I told them my upbringing and so forth and all the issues that we've gone through. And they were so shocked because they never realised a story like that was so close to them. And I think that's what happens is when people start to realize that something is closer to them and that it impacts their day-to-day lives, then they're compelled to make a choice. And that choice hopefully moves them to a point of compassion. And that's why, you know, we have to really challenge these words every single time. And for me, I found that poetry was my way of challenging these words because I feel art is humanizing. Art gives voice, not even necessarily gives voice, but it elevates the visibility of a particular people, but not through power structures, but through, like, the humanity that exists.
I guess that kind of brings it back round to your point when you were talking about, you know, the way that media and particular people reference refugees, and that it's like dehumanizing and that therefore distances us from them. So therefore we don't feel compassion towards mm-hmm. it. We don't feel compelled to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of then, I guess, effectively what, by using language like that, you're distancing.
Yeah, no, definitely. But it's definitely a tactic because it's not new. It happens absolutely across the board, and it's happening throughout slavery, throughout colonialism. It's a century-old strategy of imperialism, you know. And if we look at, like, the example I gave earlier in Congo of Evolue. Now, imagine if in English we refer to people who spoke English a bit more articulately or closer to the Queen's English as evolved. How just how, like, dehumanizing that would be, and just like normal. Okay, years down the line now, we no longer refer to them as evolved. We still make the distinctions of those people in one way or another. Yeah, and so that's exactly what goes on now. It's just a different name, but it's still a level of dehumanization that's attached. The N-word, for instance. The N-word originally came as out as a form of dehumanizing the people, removing the people of their humanity, representing them in terms of particular stereotypes that aren't even true about those people. And so unless we challenge these in our day-to-day lives, I mean, there's so many examples, like the B-word and so forth, like just so many constant examples that happens across levels of oppression. And unless we start to challenge them in our day-to-day language, our day-to-day lives, and they're just going to become normalized because they're being passed down faster than we are challenging them.
So it was really interesting that you talked about the N-word and that you didn't use it. Like, I would never use it.
Yeah.
There's also this movement to reclaim it, mm-hmm. isn't there? Or mm-hmm. I'm assuming that the B-word is a word that maybe I would reclaim. So I wanted to ask you about maybe reclaiming words or, you know, mm-hmm. is it because you're talking to Elena and I, would you have used the N-word, like, and actually explicitly said it if you'd have been perhaps with other people of colour?
Yeah. So in regards to the N-word, generally, publicly, and also if I'm around non-black people, not even people of colour, non-black people, I'm not saying the N-word, that act like the full word to you. Like, I don't want you to feel comfortable in even thinking that you can hear it, and because you've heard it, that it conjures something in your imagination. The reason being is, for me, that's an exclusively black word. And that reclamation, although it's not something that I entirely agree with, but it's an in-group conversation. It comes from the people who've had that and know what it feels like to have that label attached to them. However, going back to the example of the B-word, I don't use that. Do you know what I mean? And for me, if women want to use that to, you know, refer to themselves as a term of endearment and so forth, that is absolutely their prerogative, and it's a reclaimed word on their behalf. I, as a man who have male privilege, it is not my part to say whether or not who should be using and what. Privilege teaches you that all things are or should be made available to you, that you have access to all things. And I think that's why the N-word is such an issue, because if it continues to be used exclusively by black people, which I think it should be. It reminds white people, but also non-black people, how they've used it in the past. And I particularly like have no problem with only black people using it. I think that's just a conversation that we need to have within ourselves. It goes back to the issue of language being essentially a discourse of power, how the white identity essentially is constantly an identity that informs people who believe in it that they have access to all things. And the N-word is a reminder that you don't. And I think that's why it's such an issue.
Thank you.
Interesting that you were talking about part of the reason why you would never use bitch is because of the power that you have as a man. And what do you think about the word feminist? Feminism and intersectional feminism, because a lot of people and a lot of men feel particularly, I guess, quite like excluded from like feminism and the word and the conversations around feminism because of the word feminism, because it's like femininity. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on that? And do you identify as a feminist?
Okay, so I'll answer your last question first. I don't identify as a feminist, not because I don't agree with it or anything. I'm absolutely for the dismantling of patriarchy and gender equality on all fronts, intersectionally particularly. The reason why I don't identify as a feminist is I think there's still relative privilege with a man identifying as a feminist. I think one of the things that I've noticed is when as a man you identify as a feminist, you quickly get marked as safe. You know, like on Facebook when there's like a serious issue, humanitarian crisis somewhere, and it's like, okay, mark yourself as safe. It's like, okay, this man is safe. But what happens is a lot of men abuse that privilege that comes with identifying as a feminist, you know, because it's almost like, okay, we don't have to worry about this man doing the work of like, of decolonizing themselves and checking themselves because they identify as a feminist, and that must mean they're so much more safer than what other men are. The real challenge for men is not whether we identify as feminists, but it's about us confronting other men, other privileged men in our spaces. Like our issue is as men going where other men spaces where other men are and bringing up the issue of gender equality. So I think that that's where the challenge lies, you know, for us as men to really confront the spaces where we occupy as the majority and dismantle in that sense. And that's what I found has been kind of more effective for me. I don't really want to use my privilege to gain more privilege, if that makes sense.
I think that gives Sid and I and other like white people a lot to think about in terms of like the, I guess, the conversations and the spaces we occupy around black issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that, I don't know, but just because we're aware of like more of the injustice than like our other like white friends, we shouldn't like use that to gain more privilege in that sense.
So when I think of poets, I think of old white dead men. And that's probably a reflection of what I've been taught. But what's it like for you navigating the world as a poet, using language? What are your experiences of that?
So, like growing up, very similar perception of poetry to what you've just said. But for me, growing up and kind of escaping the traditional method of education and just reading independently and going to open mics and so forth, and just seeing people in my community, in my city, from my background, etc., who used language, who used poetry as a form of expression, of a form of like communicating their experiences, allowed me to also connect and understand that I could also do that in a particular way. And I think that's becoming, particularly through like the age of social media and internet, we're getting a much more varied representation of poetry, of literature. It's slow, but it's still kind of changing. And it's not necessarily breaking through in terms of the institutions yet, but in terms of representation and visibility online, like there's much more than there was like 15 years ago. We didn't have any teachers who grew up in the States. You know, we didn't have any teachers who understood why we were wearing our trousers down, who understood why we were saying fam. But now I'm saying, okay, I'm speaking to and working with young people, and they're saying, yeah, fam, yeah, blood, yeah, this. And I'm like, yeah, we used to say that. Yeah, we wore our trousers and we did. So you were, and I'll show them pictures. And I'm like, yeah. And like, oh my gosh. I'm like, yeah, you can do all of that and you can still go to university. You can do all of that and get a job and be professional and whatever, and make your money, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's been an interesting experience. However, poetry is still still quite seen as like male pale style, they say, you know. So that's like that's still generally the wider consensus, I think, but slowly and surely it's changing.
Yeah, I guess it's also interesting when we were talking to this guy called Chama on our mental health episode, and he was talking about like mental health in the black community, mm-hmm. and how, you know, black men are seen as aggressors, mm-hmm. and then it's like navigating that, like, okay, like poetry is like quite emotional, you know, mm-hmm. it's art, and then also navigating the identity of like a stereotype of being mm-hmm. seen as an aggressor, and like yeah. navigating that. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so when I first started out, one of the things that I got asked all the time was, do you rap? And we'd be like, okay, here's Jojo Bowling, he's going to rap. Now I'm going to just read poems. Okay, he's going to rap.
What?
And then I'm just like, okay. Essentially, like, the black male identity is typecast as being aggressive, as being, you know, almost hyper-masculine, strong, etc., etc. And we're not really granted a level of expression outside of rap. And even, like, rap itself is seen as very aggressive. When there's so many rap songs that highlight issues of, like, mental health and heartbreak and so forth, one of my favourite rap songs that does so is J Electronica's Who's Gonna Save My Soul. That is such a beautiful, melancholic song. And there's so many other examples of black male expression through different forms of art. And I guess, like, right now, there's a lot more representation. So I know so many black male poets, Solid Breaks, Yomi Sode, etc., Lionheart, David J. Pugilist, who's just, like, expressing themselves in a way that challenges the norm of what we understand to be, you know, the black male identity. And I think, like, generation by generation, we break that down and allow that to move forward.
So how can we, like, be allies to this?
Okay. Wow, that's an interesting question. I think, as an individual, the most impactful ways of being an ally is using the privilege that you have to kind of help dismantle the structures of oppression. So in fact, just being here, being using the space that you have here to put on the podcast that you do reaches so many people, and I think that's one example. But I think also it has to be within our closest spaces as well, within our relationships, within our friendships and so forth, within our families, because there's too many times where, you know, just sat over dinner and so forth, where we just allow particular expressions of prejudice to just pass by because, oh, that's just our uncle. When he has a few, he's like this and so forth, or that's just mum, or that's just... And it's very challenging because it impacts the relationship that you do have with the closest people around you. But what I found is, like, over the years, they really changed the way they see the world because of you. And though it might not seem like anything instantly, because too often when it comes to allyship, we want instant change. And in fact, even just like when it comes to dismantling structures of oppression, we're dealing with institutions that are hundreds of years old, you know, that have taken the lives of millions of people. Really, it's about, like, the space that you're in. I think that's the, like, the best way to do it, is that the space that you're in within your relative privilege, dismantle the structure in that space. And if every person is doing it relative to whatever privilege they have in those spaces, then slowly now we're definitely going to see a change, because if you take that and you multiply, it's like a ripple effect.
We have really enjoyed having you on the podcast. Thank you so much. There is one final question that we mm-hmm. always ask. So how could people find out more about you? What is your book? Where can they find it? Tell us that.
Yeah, one of the things of living in a capitalist state is, although you're anti-capitalist, you still have to find means to survive in it. Yeah, I'm a novelist. My debut novel is called No Place to Call Home. It was published in June. And if people want to support it, it's available through all the mainstream institutions and so forth. It's in all the shops. So if you can support independent bookshops, because I love independent bookshops, and I really want to see more of them stay open. But yeah, that's it, really. My social media handles is JJ_Bola on everything. Yeah, feel free to at me and so forth and carry on the conversation.
So kind of just wanted to ask, we're interested in starting like a book club, mm-hmm. and obviously your book is going to go right on there.
Oh, boom.
If you had to recommend one resource.
All right, so just to prefix that, on my website I have like book recommendations and stuff.
Okay,
so
okay,
if people
cool.
want to check out more, jjbola.com. But I would say, like, in regards to this conversation, the one resource that I would highly recommend, okay, I'm going to go for Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. It is an absolutely invigorating book, and it's about the structures of oppression and what they teach us through education, essentially. One of the points he makes in that, which was, we often see oppressed people as being dehumanized, but we do not see the oppressor as dehumanized as well, because the oppressor always given their full humanity. So he really talks, he goes into such like amazing detail. Oh my gosh, it's an amazing book.
Awesome. And then I just put this on randomly. Do you have any like readings of any of your poems?
So I can read a part of the book if that's something that you guys would like.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Great. Okay. Cool. I'm going to read a part of No Place to Call Home. So No Place to Call Home is a story about a family who come from Congo to the UK as refugees. And it looks at their lives from the perspective of the parents, but also the children, and how they navigate like modern British society. But also it looks at how they grew up in Kinshasa, what their experiences were, and what eventually led them to leave. And so it confronts the issue of home and belonging. And so I'm going to read a part of the epilogue, which essentially looks at the relationship that people have with the notion of home. If you are lucky, you will never have to remember home through your mother's tears or the rage in your father's voice when it shakes. Home will be somewhere you run to, never away from. It will never chase you away, a rabid dog hot on your heels with teeth like a shark, teeth so sharp you can already feel it cutting into you. If you are lucky, home will never up and leave you, and up and leave you, and up and leave you, to the point where whenever anyone ups and leaves you, it feels like home. You will look for them, as if they are home, because we all need somewhere to stay, even if it is a person. Somewhere safe. Somewhere warm. Home should never be to you an abusive ex-lover. It should never beat you down, taunting you with its beady eyes and clenched fists, knowing too well how much you want it and how much you hurt because it hurts you. And though it has hurt you, and you left it, you should never long for it, but you do. You wish to return to its forsaken arms to be held once more by a home, even if only for a little while. You try to remember whether you left home or if it left you. If you are lucky, its memory will never haunt you when you move on, so you not have to remember. A city is merely a collection of buildings, and buildings do not have souls, so how can home haunt you as though a ghost? But it does. Cold sweat on your forehead as you buckle to your knees, for who else wakes in the middle of the night filled with this longing, both a nightmare and a dream? You cannot tell if home is dying or if it is you, but you know you are both fighting to stay alive, at times fighting each other. Home should never break you in two, so wherever you go, you are never whole. Half of you remains where you left it, and the other half is rejected where you arrive. You are a split, flat-sided pendulum suspended in the air on each side. If you are lucky, and you were, none of this would have ever happened to you. You should have enough of home to take with you wherever you go. Yet you don't. You carry only what was left to you. Only enough to fit in the cracks of the lines in your palm. A small streak of hope. And so you hold it tight, fist clenched, with both rage and regret.
Yay!
Thank you.
Man!
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So that was JJ, whose book No Place to Call Home is out now at your local independent bookstore around the UK. Up next, professor and all-round superwoman, Jamila.
Hi, my name is Jamila Liscott. I'm also known as Dr. J. I'm a black woman scholar. I work in both New York City and I also work in Massachusetts. I'm currently a visiting assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst as a social justice education professor, and I'm also a senior research fellow at Columbia University's Teachers College. I have a Caribbean American background, and I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York.
Amazing. Well, what a privilege it is for us to have you on our podcast this month. Thank you so much. Sid and I first came across your work when you did a TED talk about language, which is why we reached out to you for this episode. So I wondered if you could maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, yourself, the work that you do, and why language is important to you and or your career.
Absolutely. Rooted in my own personal narrative, the way that I navigate multiple types of English. So with my Caribbean background, I utilize and have utilized for my entire life Caribbean Creolized versions of English, as well as Black American English that exists in my communities in Brooklyn, New York. And then as I navigated institutional spaces such as school, I was introduced to and very adept at standard forms of English. And so my own personal narrative saw some tension and some conflict with navigating different social spaces and also having to navigate these different Englishes. And then it became a point of analysis for me to think about, well, what is it about my racial identity and my linguistic identity as they intersect that affects the way that I navigate these spaces and the kind of decisions that I make and the way that I'm read when I'm within these spaces. And so it became a really important line of scholarship for me because, you know, coming out of navigating that from a personal space, I started to see that linguistic oppression and racial oppression had some very significant overlap. And utilizing those intersections, I've been able to analyze the way that inequality occurs throughout our society generally, but specifically a lot of my work focuses on systems of education and power.
Could you tell us a little bit about what is linguistic oppression and maybe any examples of that you may have?
So in general, one of probably the most prevalent examples in the communities that I come from, in Black communities, for example, is the kind of linguistic profiling that might happen via a phone call. So at a very young age, not even explicitly, but we were kind of conditioned to know that when you're making a phone call, you need to try to sound less Black, right? Because when you're on that phone call, if it's a professional phone call, then sounding too Black can really limit whatever opportunities might exist. And this has happened, there's evidence of this happening, for obviously for job interviews, but then also with housing and things, you know, if you're calling in and suddenly the real estate agent is like, oh no, there's no more housing in that area because you sound Black and they know that you might not be welcome into a particular community. And prior to that, they may have been corresponding with you via email or something. And so this kind of linguistic profiling is something that people of color navigate all of the time. I'm talking about it from the orientation of my racial identity as a Black woman, but especially in America, we have people who are multilingual, particularly Latinx communities, who might freely engage in Spanglish or Spanish, and that's heavily, heavily, heavily policed. And, you know, depending on where you are and the way that you're profiled or understood and read. So from my personal experience, what I've also noticed is that I receive a lot of affirmation for my ability to speak standard English very well, and people equate that with my intellectual ability. Whereas if they hear me speaking in the other Englishes I speak, Caribbean Creolized English or Black English, Black American English, then I am thought of as maybe ratchet. There are other words for it, you know, like there's an inferior assessment made about my intellectual ability or my value based on the way that I'm speaking. And so, you know, that has been some of the ways that linguistic oppression functions, in the sense that language becomes a social location where people can be marginalized, where there's cultural struggle, and where specifically white supremacy plays out by imposing standard forms of language and Eurocentric forms of language as being the only valid forms of language.
What is it about language that is so like deeply ingrained in, you know, like cultural heritage and identity?
So I study language from sociocultural perspectives. And the idea is that language is a social practice. It's not something that exists in a vacuum. It's not something that exists divorced from history and culture. The way that we engage with language is directly connected to the bodies who are using that language. It's directly connected to the dominant culture of a society, because language is forged within history and culture at all times. It's completely dynamic. So in my research, what I've learned is that because language is embedded in the sociocultural context that it emerges out of, it has been very central to some of the most heinous acts of oppression in our society, including American chattel slavery, colonization, imperialism. So I often use examples that show how within spaces of schooling, within colonial context, students would be physically beaten or they would be shamed for speaking their mother tongue, because it was really important that the colonizers reinforce the colonial language on the students and on the people as a way to go about this the colonization process. And there was a lot of intentionality during American chattel slavery around controlling the language and the literacies of Black bodies. And so, for example, once slaves arrived, they were separated so that they would not be in groups where they shared the same language. That was very important, right? As a way to have better control over them. But then once they were enslaved, their owners would also be very intentional about paying attention to their language. And also it was illegal for slaves to learn to read and write. Because it was illegal for slaves to learn to read and write, it had a deep impact on the questions of language and literacy and how even Black forms of language were forged within that process here in this country. And so I believe that this relationship between language and struggle exists because really what it points to is the social struggles that we're navigating. So we use language, but the way that we police language is really directly connected to the way that we police bodies. Marginalized languages are often just very connected to marginalized bodies in our society. So it's really just embedded and intersects with all the other systems of oppression that exist in our world.
Is there any way that you can expand on that a little bit more in terms of like how language specifically it relates to all these like differing identities and like varying levels of privilege and oppression?
So because, again, I study language from the lens of mostly the Black American and Black Caribbean experiences, a part of what I've learned also is around the way that societies are valued in connection with their ability to be literate. One of the justifications for viewing African communities and African peoples as less than humans, one of the justifications was that they were not literate. They did not have the kinds of literacy practices that their oppressors were used to. And so there's like this relationship between language and literacy. And then how that feeds into how we perceive people is just so important and intricate. So the perception or the framing of a person of color speaking another language or struggling to speak English or not being able to read and write fully, that feeds into an ideological phenomenon that we've all bought into about this person not being fully human. And this is something that for a long time came up in the imagery, like the caricatures of Black people throughout America. It would just be this idea of someone who's bumbling, who can't speak properly, who can't read properly, who can't write properly. And this, again, is the justification for why this person is not valuable, why this person is not fully human. And so there's this relationship, and that, again, that, and, you know, that exists at these intersections, right? So there's this racial identity, there's this linguistic identity. It's connecting into the system of oppression, of slavery, and then definitely, of course, feeding into class values as we move past the time of American chattel slavery and thinking about, well, how do we decide who gets to engage in quote-unquote social mobility in our society? So one of the ways that class struggle comes up is that when you're a person of color in our society, you learn very easily that your ability to navigate different social barriers is actually very directly connected to your ability to master standard forms of English. You know, one of the biggest critiques that I get when I trouble up this issue is like, well, you can't go to a job interview and talk like that, right? You can't speak like that within particular context because it's not right. Right. So we know we have it ingrained again at this ideological level that in order to be successful, in order to be professional, in order to be intellectually rigorous, in order to be deemed valuable and worthy within particular elite social context, you need to know how to speak a certain way and present yourself a certain way. That certain way reflects very heavily in American context white middle class values at the expense of other identities and cultural ways of knowing, including linguistic ways of engaging. And so there are all of these intersections that we buy into, and I believe that so much of it occurs at the ideological level, right? These very fundamental normative beliefs that we buy into collectively in our collective consciousness, but they fly silently below the radar in our society.
This ties in quite nicely as to how telling a person of color that they sound articulate is mm-hmm. is problematic. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm in the field of education, and like I will see news articles about a group of young people of color who learn science. It'll be on the news, like, right? It'll be like, wow, this group of young people learned science and won the science fair. But you could tell that the undercurrent message is like, wow, we're shocked. who knew, right? And so this is what happens when it comes to saying that a person of color is articulate. And it's just like, well, why wouldn't a person of color be articulate? We're capable of doing just as much as anyone else. And then it's also the part that I care about the most is what we conceptualize as articulate. So even now, I'm deemed articulate if I'm speaking again in a particular variety of English. As dynamic as the language is, as much as American English is distinct from different European forms of English, it's a white supremacist ideology that governs the types of Englishes that are seen as intellectual in our society. And so to me, what ends up happening in that is that what it does is, again, it marginalizes the linguistic practices and the other language varieties and languages that people navigate. So, for example, when it comes to Black American English, there are linguists and scholars and theorists who have established the structural complexity of Black English as it exists in America and traced its history to West African languages, so that there are features of Black American English now that I might engage in and someone writes it off as ghetto or ratchet or just bad English. But those features directly connect to the features of West African languages, because when Africans were brought over to America, they did not just suddenly erase their linguistic practices, right? They mapped a lot of it onto the kinds of languages that they had access to around them. And so much of what Black American English is now was forged throughout that process. And it's just as complex and valuable and valid as any other language, but it's disregarded, again, because of the bodies that it's tethered to. And so the problem with being called articulate is, one, of course I'm articulate because I can do as much as anyone else, but the other thing is, why does being articulate, or why does being successful, why does being intellectual always have to be like a cultural erasure process for me, so that I'm assimilating to dominant cultural and linguistic practices in order to be seen in that way?
So then what's it like when you have people from white or dominant culture appropriate language from Black culture?
To me, I personally find that unacceptable, particularly because, you know, it reminds me very much of the issues that we have around Halloween, where people from white culture or people from dominant cultures feel like it's appropriate to put on costumes of another race. Like, another racial group is not a costume that you can put on and take off. And that's the problem. The problem is that, you know, that distinction that's become very popularized around appreciation versus appropriation. There has not been enough valuing of Black people in our nation and in our society. There's more an exploitation of Black culture, and it sits in the framework of capitalism. So Black culture is so often capitalized on in Black bodies. When Black bodies continue to be disposable, when there's outcries from Black communities, the same people who casually engage in Black culture are nowhere to be found. The same people can't understand why it's not okay to leave a Black person for 4 hours on the ground after they were just shot and they were unarmed. You can't just dip in and dip out. You know, that's not what this is. And racial identity is not something you try on and take off. That's a form of reinforcing and your privilege in a way that's actually, it's like a mockery in my mind, the way that it comes across. Because there are real deep value issues in this country around Black lives that are not being dealt with. And so I personally, in my stance, do not think it's okay.
It comes back down to that idea that for people of color and for Black people, it's not optional to not talk about race and how, like, racism is a thing. Whereas for white people, you know, and people from dominant culture, it's something that, you know, that you can choose to talk about, that you can choose to, like, dip in and out of. But for other people, that's not. It's a reality that you have to address on a daily basis. I'm quite curious to know what it's like as an academic with all this knowledge. What's it like to work in institutions like Columbia, for example, when you think about how these institutions weren't necessarily initially made for Black people? You know, like, you weren't initially encouraged to be there.
And Black women too.
And Black women especially, yeah. Like, what's mm-hmm. that like as an academic?
You know, I gotta tell you, I love it. because I think the wonderful thing for me is that my work in and of itself, my scholarship is constantly living and breathing in the relevance of questions that challenge institutional spaces to live up to the moral value of really what they have not lived up to before. And so I make it my life's work to do that in both my scholarship and my practice. And so, you know, at the leadership level of these institutions, I've been at the table like, listen, this is a space that was created at the exclusion of myself and people who look like me. What does it mean for this institution to reimagine itself now in this moment in light of what we now know, in light of what needs to be done? And so for me, that's what I'm always pushing. I create, so for example, at Columbia University, I have the privilege of co-directing a youth program that I founded called Cypress for Justice. And with myself, along with a group of really amazing colleagues, we've created this space where young people from all over the city, from different racial groups, from different social locations, come together. And they learn qualitative research and academic ideas through hip-hop, through spoken word, through media literacy, through forms and cultural practices and linguistic practices that are not usually deemed by institutions as intellectual. And so as far as I'm concerned, as a scholar, as I navigate these spaces, I'm always challenging them to align themselves with the integrity of what's in most of their vision and mission statements around social diversity and social justice, particularly along the lines of saying it's not enough to open your doors to marginalized groups. You have to reimagine the way that teaching and learning and scholarship and just existing in this space looks now that you are also integrating the cultures and the languages and the ways of knowing of these other groups. I think that's where we failed as a society. We think that integration happens on this really thin level of just having different people in the same room, but we're all going to assimilate to white middle class culture. And that's what I challenge and that's what I disrupt.
What is the impact on young people today of being denied and policed on language?
We talk about the hidden curriculum a lot when we think about school spaces. So there are the things that we say to students explicitly, and then there are the silent things that they internalize that we don't necessarily say, but it's a part of in school norms. And one of those things, I remember visiting a school. It was like an all-black school, and I asked the young people why they can't speak the way in their community the way they can in school. And they were like, we just can't. And I'm like, why not? They were like, we would get kicked out. I'm like, why? They never really questioned it. It just was a part of the norm. Like, they said, we have to leave that at the door. I'm like, you have to leave a whole part of yourself at the door? Why? And you could see the confusion on their faces. And the problem is, what's violent to me is that they have already internalized that in order to be successful, in order to be fully human, in order to be intellectual, they have to let go of, erase, push away, or push down the norms that come from their own communities, the norms that come from their homes, you know? And to me, that's violent work because that continues on, right? And then what happens in the same way in the colonial process, if you're beating students for speaking their mother tongue in school, what happens when they go home? How does that shape their attitudes towards their communities? They start to buy into a system that devalues their very own people. And then they internalize oppression. And so to me, that's the part that really just, that's the part that hurts the most. Like in 2009, a Texas state representative, her name was Betty Brown, she announced that Asian Americans should adopt names that are easier for Americans to deal with. And I heard a spoken word piece by a Korean American young man about how painful it was for him to have to change his name at such a young age, so that now that he's older, he can't speak, you know, his language anymore. He can't speak to his grandmother anymore. And at the time, it was just normal for him. But as he got older and his critical consciousness deepened, he realized that he had traded in such an important part of his own history in order to feel normal and accepted within American culture. And, you know, I share that with, you know, in a lot of places that I go, and oftentimes there are people in the room who break down in tears because they spent so much time, depending on the types of communities they come from, they spent so much time changing their accent, changing their name, and trying to erase any sign of their indigenous linguistic practices as a way to have access to jobs and to power in our society. And it becomes an identity crisis, right? Because it's at the expense of your home. And again, because language carries with it history and culture, it also carries the ideologies of those histories and cultures in and of itself. And we teach it, we teach standard forms of language like they're ideologically neutral, but they're not. And so when you let go of one linguistic package for another, you're also embracing a little bit more than just words, right? You're valuing new histories, you're centering new cultures, it centers different things.
What should we do, you know, as, you know, as white allies to this?
What is the solution, and what would our role be in that?
In my life's work, what I've been working on, what does it mean to, again, reimagine institutions as pluralistic environments? So actually, while I've been taught that the language practices from my home are a deficit, then they're actually an asset, right? They strengthen what I'm capable of doing. They strengthen my linguistic and intellectual dexterity because I navigate these different forms. And so to me, the solution is to have our institutional spaces reimagine themselves to accommodate that, as opposed to having this very, like, very Eurocentric, very white middle class, specific, marginalizing body of practices that act like anything outside of that is delinquent or deficient. So I think all spaces need to be reimagined in that way. That's the ultimate goal. But, you know, in terms of allyship, I always think my role for white people is always to be in conversation and in action and in work with white communities. I think that's one of the biggest, most important contributions with the most integrity. I have found that it's sometimes more difficult for white people to speak to white communities in their minds than it is for them to, you know, try to participate in the work that marginalized groups, historically marginalized groups, are engaged in. But the truth is that people of color don't have access to white communities the way that white people do. And the truth is that people of color are also, it's also just like not okay for people of color to always have to be the ones that are constantly educating white communities about, you know, these issues. And so then it becomes really, really important for white allies to be like, yo, like, we're in, you know, we're going to do the work within our own community context. Because those are honestly the way that white privilege and white supremacy still function in our society, is that those white communities, especially those privileged white, elite white communities, are the communities that are at the helm of shaping so much of what happened in our institutional context. And so if anybody needs to be wrestling with these ideas, it's those spaces, right? And so I think that's a lot of the work that white folks need to be doing.
I guess it's one of the final questions, really, and that's about how we can support you, find out more about your work. How can people find out more about you, that kind of thing?
Feel free to check out my website, JamilaLiscott.com. I put most of my updates there. I can be found at Black Relevance. I'm on both Instagram and on Twitter. And then, you know, just, you know, Google. I have a book coming out soon, sometime next year. That's going to be specifically for educators who are looking to confront white privilege within and beyond their school context. And so, yeah, just follow me anywhere you can, and I'll keep the updates coming.
Amazing.
I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for your book.
Yeah, we said just both, like, fist pumped there at that.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. It was a real privilege to be on your show.
Oh my gosh, honestly, the privilege is ours.
Yeah, 100%.
It's an honor to have you.
Yeah, like, unreal. Like, we watched your TED talk and we just fell in love with it. It was so amazing. So I'm so honored and privileged that you, like, made the time to come on this podcast and chat to us, because I appreciate that it's probably a lot of emotional and intellectual labor on your part. So really, thank you.
Thank you.
Jamila's TED Talk, 3 Ways to Speak English, is up on TED, and we would highly recommend it if you want an accessible way to know more about how language has a bearing on opportunity and social mobility. Last but not least, it's Gary.
So my name's Gary. I recently turned 35 years old. I'm white, cis, gay, non-disabled, and I'm most definitely a feminist. I was formerly Director of Communications for Change.org, the online petition platform, and now I'm a professional journalist specialising in language.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We're really excited to have you on the podcast this month. We've read your pieces in The Guardian and they're really, really eye-opening. I just wanted to quickly ask, so you said that you'd most definitely identify as a feminist. And one of the things that we found when doing this research or this podcast in particular is when we've had other men on it, you know, we've asked, oh, what do you think of the word feminism, feminist? Do you identify as a feminist? And there's kind of like a mixed bag of responses. Some say that, you know, they can't identify as a feminist because of male privilege, but then some say, you know, feminism is all about equality for everyone and all genders, no matter what. And so I'm interested to know what your stance is on this.
I'm of the Chimamanda school of thought, we should all be feminists. Hopefully some of your listeners would know. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie and her TED Talk, We Should All Be Feminists. Always really great that people check their privilege. And as a white man, I want to be someone that does that. But as a white gay man, feminism is really important to me, and it's a really important label, just because one of the things I've perceived as someone that's gay, and, you know, self-identifies as gay, it's been quite a journey. You know, I came out at a time when there was a Tory government, my dad read the Daily Mail every day, society and everyone was telling you that being gay was lesser than, it was inferior. And I actually thought about it quite a lot growing up, and I thought a lot of the homophobia that I've perceived in my life isn't actually homophobia at all. I think a lot of it is about gender. And it's something, there's this term that I've coined, which I call the patriarchal pedestal. And that is that anyone that subscribes to that version of masculinity is seen as superior. And anyone that kind of rejects it in any way, shape or form, and that includes people that self-identify as gay and perhaps include some of the more stereotypical kind of like camp elements of gay and own that, I would say that they are rejecting the patriarchal pedestal, and therefore they get treated as someone that is insane because they have let go of, you know, the one thing that supposedly makes them superior in society, which is the bravado of masculinity. And I reject that. I reject toxic masculinity, and I identify very prominently as a feminist for those reasons, just because I think gender comes into play so much with sexual orientation.
It's really interesting to hear about the intersections of homophobia and sexism and gender, because I know that especially when you're looking at school children, the people who experience homophobic bullying will be girls who are really good at sports or boys who aren't so good at sports, and thinking about how that has a way of perhaps policing our own and gender, and thinking about like your role in it too. I was wondering if you could tell us about the importance of language, and in particular what happens when it gets hijacked.
Hijacking is quite concerning, although it depends how you frame it. So like you might want to frame it as like some language gets hijacked, but another way of framing it is just that that's what language does, because it never stays still. It's not a fixed thing, it's constantly evolving, the rules are always changing, and sometimes it gets hijacked, but sometimes that hijacking can be quite creative and interesting and exciting, and other times it can be quite concerning. You get these grammar purists who, I think it all started with a woman called Lynn Trust, who wrote a book called Eat, Shoots and Leave, and talked about how it really upset her whenever she saw a grammatical mistake, which was quite often out in the world. And that started this kind of new wave of grammar purism that you saw, where people were real sticklers for where apostrophes went and for the right use of language, you know. And it's kind of a redundant fight, because no matter how you frame it, language will always evolve and it will always change, and the meaning that is loaded onto certain words will always change. And in some ways there's a really good social and empathetic reason to fight against that, which I'll talk about in a second, and that's when it gets hijacked to nefarious ends, I'd argue. But there are other times when perhaps we need to go with the creativity and the evolution of linguistics, and just accept that that's the way it is, and that can be done, you know, reluctantly, you know, even with emojis and realising that this is just a new way we communicate now. But in terms of hijacking, I think, you know, one of the words that immediately when you use that word hijacking, I thought of the word snowflake, which is one that has been batted around by both the left and the right quite recently. So whenever someone takes offence, you know, offence culture is so pertinent in our society at the moment. I first saw it being used by the right whenever the left would complain about perhaps language that was derogatory or sexist or racist or not very inclusive. People on the right would say, you're just being a snowflake, you need to harden up. And now I've seen it used quite often on Twitter, especially by those on the left and, you know, fellow Guardian writers calling the people on the right snowflakes when they get upset and angry about everything. So it kind of almost cancels each other out. And it, so like, this, you know, the left are hijacking this insult that's thrown at them from the right, and they're throwing it back to the right, and everyone's a snowflake. So it's just this snowstorm of offence. But probably the second word that sprung to mind when you talked about hijacking was the word gay. And that's a word that's really important to me. And, you know, it's a label that I feel a lot of ownership over and a lot of pride about, because the journey that I had to go on in order to self-define as gay was not an easy one. And I had to expose parts of myself that were quite raw and quite vulnerable in order to self-define as that label. And, you know, it probably wasn't until I was way into my 20s that I, in any workplace or any situation that I was in, that I could say I'm gay without feeling a tinge of shame or embarrassment. And the really concerning hijacking for me of that term was when youth colloquialism and slang started to use gay as a synonym for anything inadequate or anything inferior. So, you know, you're so gay or that's so gay. They might even, you know, it could even be used to describe an inanimate object that they thought was crap, and they'd say that's gay. And although language's evolution excites me 9 times out of 10, this is that one of those 1 times out of 10 that I am going to fight back, and I will fight hard against that hijacking, because that is not okay. And, you know, in a society where homophobia is still pervasive and is still, you know, it perhaps is a little bit more insidious now than it used to be, but it's still there, we know that. And and when we hear gay bandied around as a synonym for anything rubbish, it's not a big leap for that someone to then think, well, gay people are rubbish and gay people are inferior and gay people are inadequate. And it's that kind of hijacking that I think we need to fight against. So I actually used to manage the press office for Stonewall, the UK gay and lesbian lobbying and campaigning charity. And during my time there, that was one of our big campaigns. We had a huge campaign to tackle homophobic bullying in schools, which was absolutely rife after a law called Section 28, the law that made it illegal to promote homosexuality in schools, and it was introduced by the Thatcher's government. And Stonewall was actually a charity founded in direct response to Section 28, and initially it was a single-issue charity which was founded with the purpose of repealing Section 28, and it later grew to tackle all forms of homophobia in British life. But its biggest flagship campaign was the tackling of homophobia and homophobic bullying in Britain's schools, and it had festered under Section 28. There'd been a real epidemic of homophobic bullying that had been left unchallenged because of this really pernicious law. And it was a demeaning and offensive law. And thanks to Stonewall's lobbying and Tony Blair's government, it was actually repealed after being in place for 15 years in 2003. So we were cleaning up a hangover of mess of homophobia. And one of the things that had come out from that was this misuse of the term gay in the playground. So I went back to my old school where homophobia was rife, my old comprehensive school in Kent. And I went there with Cyrian McKellen, who was one of the founders of Stonewall, and we went there together. And I remember sitting there in my assembly hall where I'd sat there as a very nervous, very closeted gay teenager. And I sat in that very same assembly hall and I listened to Ian McKellen explain to a room full of students why that misuse of that hijacking of that term gay was so demeaning and so offensive and so dangerous in the homophobic hate crime that it could lead to, or the homophobic bullying that it could lead to. And I was in tears, because I remember imagining what would this have felt like if I was 14 years old and I was hearing this assembly. And it was so powerful for me to hear someone so eloquent in that mellifluous voice of his to challenge something that meant so much to me. So I'm hoping that as a result of his, you know, he was touring around hundreds of schools on behalf of Stonewall to tackle that issue, which, you know, as you can just see from the spiel I've just given you, that one hijacking of that one word leads you to talk about so much that's so personal for you.
Yeah. I tell you what's interesting is that
through the school report and the way that you're talking about like the hijacking of language and specifically around That's So Gay, that still happens. And so the work is still needed, and the overhang of Section 28 is still very much here. But also everything has shifted ever so slightly in that schools are taking homophobic bullying more seriously, but they may not be taking biphobic bullying more seriously. And they're definitely not really thinking about transphobic bullying in language. And then that veers more into how we support trans young people in schools. But when it comes to things being so gay, there are some schools that are doing fantastic, amazing work, and no kid would use that word as a derogatory way. And there are other schools where they still have that conversation to be had. And the issue is probably exactly the same as when you were touring with schools. It's the teacher's confidence to be able to challenge that and not have the fear of having to explain what being gay is or means, and actually that, you know, everyone should be accepted without exception, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, I think we're all on the journey when it comes to transphobic language or biphobic language. You know, it can be a real slip of the tongue sometimes, you know. And I have to confess, you know, I've been guilty of it myself. There's been times when I've used language and I've thought back and I thought that probably wasn't appropriate. And the concerted, insidious way that gay was being used really upset me, and it's good to see that there's a slight shift. But I think that, you know, when you talk about biphobic language, you know, a while ago I wrote a column for The Guardian about biphobia and about all of the pernicious kind of stereotypes that get thrown at the bisexual community and bisexual people, and upsettingly a lot of it is also by gay people, and that really upset me, and I did a piece about that, and about how pervasive that can be. So yeah, I love the fact that we've started to move on to challenge in a more sophisticated way, challenge now biphobic language and transphobic language. And I think it's really interesting as well, like, you know, I'm definitely not an advocate for censorship. The column that I wrote for the Guardian was called Mind Your Language, and some of my friends used to chat with me saying it's so ironic that you write that column because you've got a mouth like a toilet. And it was ironic that I can use expletives and colourful language, you know, as much as the next person. And my column was called Mind Your Language. But what I would try to convey in my column was that, like, no one should be censored. Absolutely, I'm not for that. But I am for consideration. The language that you might use behind closed doors to your boyfriend and to your friends might be completely different to that you'd use in the public arena. And context is everything.
I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about how that you've been guilty of it before, you know, that you've said things that you weren't necessarily proud of. And I think that's important to recognise, because I'm the same. Like, I remember when I was at uni, and that wasn't that long ago. That was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. And in second year, I was still bandying around the term, oh my God, that's so gay. And the reason that I think it's important to stress this is that we're not perfect. Like, Sid and I are not perfect. And I'm not lumping Sid into this, because
I am.
Probably. Sid is perfect. And it took for me to have like a gay housemate at uni when we were just having a conversation, and I was like, oh my God, that's so gay. And then he went along with it. He was like, oh my God, I know, right? And then I kind of had to like step back a little bit and was like, wow, I'm really sorry. That's really offensive to lump a part of your identity into something that's really negative and derogatory. And it like took that for me to realise.
Yeah, I've got an example too. I used to say that something was lame all the time. I had no idea. Well, I mean, I knew what it meant, I suppose, but I just used it. And then at one point I was with my friend who was a wheelchair user, and he said, don't use that, Sid. And I was like, whoa, okay. I try to be so good at this stuff, because I've been trying for a few years, I suppose. But no, that we've all got a long way to go. And I suppose the thing is that you can find other words to explain what it is that you're trying to say. And once you realise it, and once you notice it, you start noticing when other people say it, and it's kind of your responsibility, I suppose, to kind of point it out, so that you're not leaving it to the gay housemate or, you know, the one friend who's disabled to point it out to you, because how much emotional labour is that on them?
The other thing is, and this goes back to context, that there are people that sometimes use it ironically, you know, ironic use. I've heard gay people use that for gay, and I know that they're doing it to be ironic, and they're doing it, and in a way, it's a reclaiming of back back to that word, so they've got the power again. So the same might go for disabled people that positively use the word claimant and have their reasons for it, because they know they've been ironic. But I just think sometimes let's not lose our sense of humour in this. You know, a more equal society is one that's more relaxed about language and one that can laugh at itself more easily. But when we're not equal, we're not there yet. It all depends on the context. But I'm all for ironic use. I don't want us to get to the point where we're policing all language, but I do think when someone tells you that, you have to hear them. When your disabled friend did that to you, you know, you have to hear it and accept it, because that's important to them.
I think it's funny because it seems like it always comes back down to power and almost structural power, in the sense that I, as a white person, would never say the N-word, because even though in some contexts it's been reclaimed and it's very, like, you know, some people in the black community will still use it right now, and I'm not sure if it would ever be okay for me to say it, because I structurally have more power than a black person. And so it's interesting, yeah, you know, that you were saying, you know, kind of the context and who's saying it comes into it.
I 100% agree. And in an article for The Guardian about reclaiming words, and I couldn't even type the full word because I felt so uncomfortable with the N-word. And you see the same, I mean, I live in Australia now, and you see the same debate around Aboriginal people and some of the derogatory terms that are used for them. And, you know, and it is very, very well accepted that it is a complete no-no, certain words that you just don't go near. And I think that's progress in a way. I wouldn't see that as censorship. I would just see that as a progress of more humanising and, you know, a more considerate approach to language.
I kind of wanted to ask you about the appropriation of queer language and queer culture. What do you think on that? What's your take?
There is a lot of debate around gay colloquial lexicon. The gay colloquial lexicon has a fascinating history. Gay people actually did used to have their own language. It wasn't quite a language, it's what's called a cryptolect, which is a lexicon, like a coded language that's used to hide away in the shadows, but also to acknowledge a member of your other community in a way that either builds solidarity or lets them know quite discreetly that they're one of your kind. The Polari, based on Yiddish and some old French, and there's a bit of pig Latin in there. There's some wonderful backslang. It all happened in the 50s in Britain when homosexuality was outlawed. But the cover was blown and the coded language was exposed when there was a radio show called Round the Horn, which came out and popularised Polari. And it no longer held the same power about discreetly letting people know that you were gay, so that you wouldn't get detected by the police or by disapproving prudish conservative society. And the cover was blown and Polari died out. Now, what I would argue is that's been replaced by a really interesting new gay colloquial lexicon. The interesting appropriation part, and I'd say this is the modern day Polari, is the black female language that we appropriate. The girlfriend with the clicking of the fingers. Yes, queen. No, she didn't. Hey, girl, hey. You know, slay, throw in shade, all of those kind of terms are borrowed from what's perceived as the black female community. I think that this is exactly what language does. As I said earlier, it gets co-opted, it morphs, it evolves, and sometimes it's corrupted. And I can understand that there might be some people in the black female community that are saying that's appropriation and actually you're taking the piss and it's not on. It isn't just owned by the black female community. There is a wonderful, wonderful documentary called Paris is Burning. It's set in the 1980s in Harlem in New York, and it's all about the black gay male experience. And they talk about their race and their sexual orientation, putting them to the bottom of the pile during that time in New York. And in order to reclaim that power, they created their own microcosm, and that included language. And it's a fascinating subculture. And out of this subculture, all of these terms, throwing shade, came from the Paris is Burning era. And yes, queen, and a lot of the language that you see in Paris is Burning, it is part of the black female experience, but it was also part of the black gay male experience back in that time. And that's such an important history that we can't let go of. I would argue it's not appropriation, but it's kind of not my place to argue that. I'm not a black woman, so I would love to hear more about what black women think about that debate, because I reckon there's probably diversity of opinion on it.
And I think it's really important to acknowledge what different people's points of view might be, because there is this whole line, isn't there, between appreciation and appropriation. And even if there might be ways that even Elena and I might identify with black women, for example, and really learn from whatever it is that they have to say, there is always going to be an element of we will not understand what it is that like to be a black woman, and it is not our place to co-opt, or it often it's just about listening, and where we can, challenging racism or sexism in the spaces that we have access to. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How can we be better allies when it comes to language? Maybe specifically from your angle about the LGBT community and reclaiming words and hijacking words, like what can we do to be better allies, us and our listeners?
I think the way that we can be better allies is to not lose our sense of humour. I would much more rather live in a society where offence becomes a redundant position because we've got to the stage where society is much more equal and much more relaxed to laugh at itself, point at itself and laugh. And I would much sooner advocate for a society where every term is permissible, you know, get everyone to understand that you come from a place that you it's absolutely ludicrous that you would even consider not treating them equally, and that is not even that is not even up for debate anymore. And then get to a place where you can have fun and be playful and reclaim language in a way that you're using an insult that's been used to demean us, and we find it endearing, and you don't even have to explain why, because we all know where the place where that comes from. That's the society I want to live in, because that's when really creative things happen with language. We're starting to see some of that solidarity between different groups, and I think between the black women and the gay man experience, perhaps we're starting to see some of that too now, when people are coming out and saying we share so much. You know, and although our experiences are different and our power might still be very different, we can still have fun with language, and we can still build solidarity through playful language and humour.
And then how can we find you? I mean, we know that you write amazing articles for The Guardian, but how can we and our listeners follow you and support your work?
So I'm writing regular columns for the Oxford Dictionaries blog, so please check them out, follow them on Twitter, and you'll find a lot more of my language pieces there. And you can also, I write features, op-eds. I don't just write about language, I do a lot of interviews, so you can check me out on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at GaryNunn1.
Boom! And that was episode 18, Language. As ever, if you want to know more, please check out the resources our guests suggest, as it's coming directly from them. Or better yet, support their work. Currently, all of our guests who do this podcast do it out of their own time with no payment. So if you liked what you heard and you're able to afford it, spend a tenner on one of their books, donate to a charity they care about, or platform their perspective. It really is worth it. Feedback, suggestions, and feminist memes can be sent to us at www.kickingthekyriarchy.org, Facebook, Kicking the Kyriarchy, Twitter, at Kick Kyriarchy, or email us, kickingthekyriarchy@gmail.com. Sid.
Yeah?
I've got a joke.
Okay.
The past, the present, and the future walked into a bar. It was tense.
Oh, Elena.
You loved it.
Special thanks to assistant producers Becky Malone and Emma Hallahan for helping out with this episode.